Hello, Happy New Year, such as it is. I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello, Jane Crowther.
Hello, Jamie Graham, and Happy New Year to you two.
And to you too.
This week, we'll be talking to Vanessa Kirby about her new film, Pieces of a Woman, and reviewing that along with Jackie Chan's latest Vanguard, plus documentaries Mare and Robin's Wish. But before we get to those, we should probably talk about the entertainment we got our eyes on this Christmas period. What were you boys watching during the festive season?
I might shock you and I might destroy any cred that I have left. But I caught up with one of last year's Christmas movies, Cats. And
oh my God.
I'm going to whisper this. I quite liked it.
No.
Matthew Leyland.
Yeah.
Do you need
I mean, I went in with absolutely zero expectations, of course. You know, this
what
is the worst.
What exactly did you enjoy about it?
Just how weird it was. Just how strange and weird and unpredictable. And just watching A-listers stick whiskers on and behave in very not really human, not really animal type ways. I've just never seen anything like it.
And cats without bums.
Yeah, cats without bums. Yeah, these very kind of suggestive tails waggling all over the place. complete absence of story or sense.
Had you been at the Baileys at this point?
I had a little bit, yeah. I did have COVID over Christmas as well, so that might have affected my...
So the combo of your COVID and your beverages may have influenced your enjoyment here.
Yeah, being stuck indoors. Wow. Yeah, I have to say, I've seen worse, I've got to say.
Did you watch it with your young son?
I think if I'd seen that as a child, it would have absolutely terrified me.
Yeah.
It's a new certificate film. It's the scariest you I've ever seen. It would have
freaked me out.
The logic of it is mental. Like,
there's no logic.
Some of them wear clothes and hats and coats.
Yeah.
Don't. Obviously, there's the much talked about Rebel Wilson incident with the unzipping of a skin, which is a child is terrifying. I found Idris Elba's like weird eyes just terrifying, and then like their size seemed to disappear up and down, and sometimes they were a certain size and sometimes they were a different size, sometimes sort of the size of a dog, sometimes not. Very odd.
Ray Winston
and
pops
Ray
up.
Winston.
Ray Winston.
I mean, yes. Well, I'm glad you were spending your COVID-y Christmas in such a constructive way. Jamie, what were you watching?
Well, not Christmas. It was after Christmas, but I've just caught up with the new season of Cobra Kai, season three.
Yes.
Which I've been waiting for a long time, immensely excited by, and it kind of lived up to everything I hoped for, really. But it went a bit deeper into the past. We learnt about John Kreese, how he became the evil man he became. We went back to Vietnam and saw his background. Daniel LaRusso, played by Ralph Macchio, obviously, he went to Japan in this one, so sort of got back in touch with everything that made Mr. Miyagi special and his former karate special. And then obviously it continued the story from the first two seasons, which is kind of full of emotion and nostalgia, and it's fun, and at the same time it has a little bit of depth to it, perhaps more than you'd expect. And I enjoyed the whole season, but the last two episodes were so perfect, so spot on, that I came out of it kind of grinning my head off. And
did you have a little cry?
I didn't have a little cry, but I definitely I welled up. I mean, I don't want to give any spoilers away, so I'm not going to, but this whole thing, in all three seasons, people keep popping up from the films. You know, we're getting support roles and cameos, and there's a big one in season three that I've been waiting for. And when they pop up and sort of what they do in their couple of episodes really move me, and also just made me so happy. So I'm kind of on cloud nine after that. Bring on season four.
I watched Black Narcissus. That was my Christmas treat. Gemma Arterton taking on the Deborah Kerr role of the classic film and also the book. Very beautifully done. Gorgeous cinematography, lovely production design, but not really different enough from that film. Yeah. I mean, it's Powell and Pressburger. It's lush and gorgeous enough as it is, the original. And this sort of really sort of leaned into that. These gorgeous skies, gorgeous mountains, very lovely lighting. And I didn't really know what the point of it was. However, I did think Alessandro Nivola improved on Mr. Dean, played by David Farrow in the original film, because obviously in that film, he wore shorts a lot and rode a tiny pony. Was just inexplicably tiny pony. And so I think Alessandro Nivola had been sort of tapping into his inner Indiana Jones, which I enjoyed.
Did he wear shorts as well?
No shorts. Yeah. Not a short in sight. Actually,
what, just pants? Or does he have trousers on?
Trousers,
well?
Jamie. Oh, right. Okay. Goodness me. But yeah, there was definitely a frisson between him and Gemma Arterton as Sister Clodagh. So it was good, but felt a little unnecessary.
It's very much on my watch list because the original movie I adore, like I adore most of Powell and Pressburger's films, and I'm very interested to see, even if it is very similar, I'm interested to see what they've done. So I have to get to it.
Okay, so shall we get to what we can actually watch this week? I mean, obviously, everything's gone wrong again. If you're in the UK, you're in lockdown, but you can see this on Netflix. Get your tissues ready for this.
I wanted to stay at home. I wanted the baby to decide when she wanted to come.
My daughter came into this world. For the time that she did.
And I can't bring her back.
So that's Pieces of a Woman, starring Vanessa Kirby as a woman who loses her baby during childbirth and struggles to come to terms with the grief and society's discomfort with a mother's mourning. Before we talk about the film, let's hear from Vanessa Kirby when Total Film sat down with her to talk about the 2020 she's had, which, while a horror show for everyone else, has seen her crowned Best Actress at the Venice Film Festival.
I've had moments of complete magic, really. Like the fact that Venice Film Festival went ahead and we were all able to be there in person, all together, sitting in a cinema watching films, reminding me how important our industry is. And it just was such a beautiful communal experience. And I can't wait to it all back, being able to do that.
We also asked what it was like to be suddenly famous with The Crown, her breakout role.
It felt like a really long time, I think, because I started off doing stage work for many, many years, all up and down England, you know. And when you're doing that, you know, it might be 300 people a night only. And honestly, I think things started to change when we did The Crown. And that was something which, you know, Netflix was still quite early days in those days. And we had no idea that if anyone would even watch it. And suddenly it kind of came out and people started talking about it. And it seemed like many more people we ever imagined watched it. And that was so beautiful because we really loved that show. And I love that character more than anyone I've ever played. And so suddenly the idea of someone sort of watching something out of choice and something you love meant a lot to me that it was on that show, I guess, that people actually watched something I did.
And how she chooses her projects. Was it intentional to mix big budget blockbusters like Fast and Furious and Mission Impossible with smaller art house movies like this one?
Not really consciously. I mean, Mission Impossible came along just because I was on The Crown and Chris McQuarrie had seen it and sort of approached me and we started chatting. And I never imagined myself in action movies because, like I said, I really came from the stage. But I thought it was something that would be so challenging and it really scared me. I'm really not a very physical person. At school, I was always the last one in the running race, you know what I mean? So it was more like overcoming a personal challenge and also setting the kind of intention of trying to create a character and a woman that was sort of complex in a very alpha world, you know what I mean? That was my intention. And I was very glad to come back and do Well to Come and Pieces of a Woman because it required such a kind of emotional intensity. And that's where I'm really, really happy. It was lovely to come back. And I imagine this is where I'll stay, really. Hopefully.
Watching Pieces of a Woman is tough. Was it as difficult to play as it is to watch?
It was, especially looking back. I knew that my responsibility was to honour the women that had told me their stories about losing a child at any stage of pregnancy or just after they're born or later too. And the whole time when I was filming, I really felt connected to them and I felt like it was for them because their story hasn't been told before. It's something that's so kind of silenced in society. And I learned the statistic the other day, 54% of people know someone or have been through a miscarriage of stillbirth or neonatal death. And yet it's really so rarely spoken about. So I kind of felt that I was part of that. And the biggest challenge, I guess, as the actor was to try and embody and do justice to their feelings about what that experience and that trauma is like. So every day, that's all I concentrated on, was just try to really understand them and really get to know how it was for them, try and do that for them. And so it took me a long time to come out when I got home. And then it was the pandemic hit, which was crazy for all of us. And I had to really sort of process and let go of that grief. You know, for Martha, the character, it's a good 6-7 months of really hard days.
So, Jamie, this is obviously, I said at the top, this is about a woman losing a child. Yeah. What else is it about?
Well, it's very much the first 25 minutes or half an hour of a movie is a protracted birth scene that's all done in one take, and it's kind of astonishing and very moving and magical and traumatizing and horrible and all these things mixed into one, all the panic of giving birth. And then obviously, you know, things don't go well, stillborn baby, which, not giving too much away, that's kind of what the movie's about. The rest of the movie is very much a portrait of a splintering marriage. It's Martha, played by Vanessa Kirby, her and her husband Sean, played by Shia LaBeouf. It's them trying to kind of put their life back together and cope with this terrible, terrible loss and their inability to do so. I mean, Martha kind of goes very silent and into herself, can't face it at all, can't talk about it, the taboos from society where there's so much sort of shame and judgment involved, and it's just too much to bear, it's just too much to take on. And then the husband, played by Shia, obviously also completely broken, but he's trying to kind of put his life back together, or wants to kind of talk about it, which his wife isn't able to do. So they go about grieving in a very different way and kind of fall apart and become distant. So the rest of the film is about their crumbling marriage. So it's not the happiest watch, you could say.
It's also, let's not forget, there's also Ellen Burstyn playing Martha's mother, and she has a whole different agenda. And she very much sort of plays the role of society in this idea of, we have to get on with it, we have to, you know, pull our trousers up and march on, sort of thing. And she has an interesting backstory, which is revealed. It is very, very interesting taking this event that we don't really see very often in cinema portrayed like this, of childbirth, given as much time as it's given in the film. And as you say, this amazing opening sequence, which is one shot. I spoke to Vanessa for the magazine, and she told me that they sort of rehearsed this scene several times and then played it in real time four times over, and then the director selected the one he liked the best. It's just incredible and really draws you into this couple's life and this expectation of this child that's about to be born, so that when disaster strikes, it really hits you, doesn't it? It's so emotionally devastating.
Well, we should say that it may sound like a 25-minute birth scene. You may say, well, that's not much. You know, some women are in labour for 24 hours or whatever. But 25 minutes on screen in an unbroken take is a hell of a long time that you feel
you're there. It feels longer, yeah.
Oh, you feel you're there for hours, going through all the panic and the exuberation and everything. And like you say, Jane, you see how much their life is geared up towards this event, that, you know, it's their everything, and they've got the nursery ready and they're so excited by it. And Shia is like an architect, a builder who's building a bridge, and he's already dedicated it to his daughter and says she'll be the first person to go over it when it's finished and all of this. So everything is about this moment, and then the moment arrives and is cruelly, cruelly taken away from them, and you really feel that impact. I mean, the one shot thing, you do get some long takes where it's almost ostentatious showing off, where you kind of think, oh, they're just saying, look how clever we are here.
Yeah, we've got a Steadicam.
Yeah. But in this one, it really just immerses you in the scene, and kind of you don't even notice it's one shot, really, because you're just lost in that moment, and you're there with them at their side, doing the heavy breathing, doing the back run, getting in the bath. So it's quite an extraordinary sequence, really.
And, you know, this whole idea as well, that this is inspired by the director and the screenwriter, who are together in real life, their own experience of an infant loss. And they were very keen to show the female experience of this and the potential mother's experience of this. Do you think it does delve into that sort of grief? And is it something that everybody can understand?
I think people can understand it, even if you've not been through it. I think, you know, you can just see how much, obviously, starting a family, you know, how much that means to people, and it's kind of what society is built on and the progression of a human race is built on. And to have that taken from people and to suddenly have this complete limbo, this complete void open up before them. And like you said, it is a personal story. The director and his wife, who's the writer, have been through it themselves. And I think I've read in interviews that they said that writing this, it was originally a play and then turned into a movie. I just hope that they found it a really healing process, because I think so many people, it's such a big event. How can you talk about it and people suffer in silence? And obviously a far more healthy thing to do, if you can find the strength to do it, is to talk about it and to sort of confront it and work through it, which I think in making this film they have done, and fair play to them. I mean, it's a very affecting film.
It is. And Vanessa hasn't had a child herself and hasn't experienced this either. And she spent a lot of time with women who had, and watching women give birth in order to make sure that she did this well. She won the Best Actress award at Venice. Do you think she's going to get awards for this role? She's excellent in it, I think.
I think she'll certainly be in the pack. I think, you know, when you get these awards cycles, when they gear up and you're sort of moving steadily towards the big one, the Oscar, you tend to get the same sort of 5, 6, 7 people nominated for every award. And I think she'll certainly be one of those for the Best Actress. You know, I think she could win it. And if she did, fair play, it would probably be deserved as much as anyone else. I mean, it's a very brave role to take on. Like you said, she hasn't been through it herself, but you really feel she understands it and has internalized it. I think Shia LaBeouf is very good in it as well.
He's so good. Yes, it's obviously there's a difficulty talking about Shia at the moment because of things that are happening in his personal life. But just purely as an actor, this just shows how magnetic he is and how he is just a living, breathing person of grief, isn't he, in this? And you feel everything for him.
And also he brings something of himself to it, because his character has been sober for like 6 years in this film. And then as he starts to grieve deeper and deeper and can't connect with his wife, and they're falling apart and this chasm is opening up, the way he deals with it rather inevitably is he starts smoking again and he starts drinking again and then doing drugs again. And, you know, so he goes back into that horrendous thing, which, you know, we all know from Shia's own background is something he very much understands.
Feels like very much an important film and something that is very informative to watch and beautifully done.
Yeah, like you said, it's very well done. You know, it's all sort of muted palette and very slow moving, in a not in a boring way, but in a very sort of just steady, controlled way. The only thing I'd say for me, there's a few moments of symbolism in the film which are a bit heavy-handed, which I won't go into because, you know, a bit of a spoiler I found, especially the last 5 minutes, although it was moving, it kind of did its job, but it was a bit kind of screenplay-y, if you know what I mean.
I know which scene you're talking about. I understand what you're saying. And there is a certain scene as well that feels quite stagey and does betray its sort of stage origins, I suppose. But I can forgive those because of the virtuoso aspect of the opening and the fact that sort of this taboo about talking about infant death, or even death in general and grief, is very interesting. We don't do it as a society, and we don't encourage people who have lost children to discuss that experience. And there's this awkwardness. I mean, there's this scene where she goes to her office. She's not having her maternity leave. She goes back to work and she has no baby. And the just horrific awkwardness of all of her colleagues in not knowing what to say, not knowing how to approach it, her not knowing how to interact with them, is just really heartbreaking and very interesting. So I think we can say we're highly recommending this on Netflix. It was supposed to be in cinemas, sadly isn't, but it is on Netflix right now.
And also we should probably say it's the English language debut of Cornel Mundruczó, if I'm pronouncing that correct, which no doubt I'm not, but he's a Hungarian director who did White God, about the doggy uprising, the canine uprising in Budapest.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it's great. And then he did Jupiter's Moon, which is a kind of Syrian refugee drama where a Syrian refugee is shot and then becomes like imbued with superhero powers. Very strange movie, quite good. When you get international directors move to do the English language debut, sometimes it's not as good as their other work, but there's just a slight tin ear for dialogue and things like that. But I think for an English language debut, this is really, really encouraging and really strong. And, you know, so if he wants that career to move into Hollywood, I think it's very much there for the taking.
So that is Pieces of a Woman, which is on Netflix right now. Should we move on to something completely different then?
Yeah.
Let's have a go at this.
Vanguard again. What's Vanguard?
Vanguard is an international private security company. Most of them are retired military or security experts. Their services include security for VIP protection.
So this is Vanguard, which is... Matthew's laughing already, and I have pages and pages of notes on this. This is atrocious. Matthew, what's it about?
Well, this is action veteran Jackie Chan's latest movie. He's 66, but he's still in the action genre. And it's basically Vanguard is a security firm, which Jackie's character is the head of. Mm-hmm. And they get involved in a mission to save an accountant from this group called the Brotherhood of Vengeance. A pretty subtly named group.
Don't forget the Baltic Wolves. They're in it as well.
Yeah, the Baltic Wolves. Yes, this Middle East terror group who've kidnapped this accountant. So him and his younger team set out on an international mission to rescue him, which goes from Piccadilly Circus in London to Africa to Dubai. And it's got real sort of overtones of like Bond movies and Fast and Furious. It's directed by Stanley Tong, who's worked with Jackie Chan quite extensively. He started working with him in the 90s. So he's behind things like First Strike and more recently Kung Fu Yoga. So fans of their work together will probably be interested. Yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag, as Jane was saying.
It's so bad. It reminded me of The Room, where I was watching it and I was annoyed by it and irritated by it and just like, what am I watching? To the point that I then went through a sort of epiphany into absolutely loving it because it was so terrible. I mean, the dialogue is terrible. The acting is extremely wooden.
It's been very bad acting.
Something quaintly old-fashioned about it. It's got dreadful CGI. You know, you've got robot bees and robot pigeons, jumping cars, hoverboards, a CGI lion that's the least convincing thing since Cats, a CGI waterfall, a CGI limo. I mean, this is
a lot
dreadful.
CGI.
Non-specific sort of Middle Eastern baddies who are just putting deposits down on weapons of mass destruction. There's no character development whatsoever. Weird Chinese propaganda, strange blackface jokes, and people say things like they're strapping a bomb to him whilst we watch a man having a bomb strapped to him. It's like a child's movie if it wasn't quite violent. It fades to black after every scene in a sort of weird old-fashioned
way.
It's just weirdly expensive and horribly cheap at the same time. More brilliantly, it involves a blooper reel, which I enjoy, you know, Smokey and the Bandit style, which includes the bit where Jackie Chan nearly dies for his art by being drowned under a jet ski in a stunt and handing out ice lollies to the crew during an African scene. This is such a weird anomaly of a film. I loved it. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, for all those reasons. And plus, Jackie sings the theme tune at the end as well. There's one final treat. He sings the theme tune over the end credits, a la Dennis Waterman.
So
I enjoyed that. I mean, I absolutely adore Jackie Chan. I love his early films and his mid-period films. I mean, obviously, he's 66, so he can't hurl himself around as much. But, I mean, he still gets into some of the thick of the action. There's lots of younger actors who kind of act as his surrogates in this film, and they're quite capable with the martial arts. But yeah, I mean, it is incredibly cheesy.
So he's sort of there for comic relief nowadays, isn't he? He does a lot of sort of slides and he holds hot things and does hot sort of things. That's his role in this. And sort of being the sort of Charlie to the Charlie's Angels sitting behind
him. Yeah, he kind of does a bit of mentoring. Some of the production design is kind of really, I won't reveal these vehicles that are unveiled at the end, but I mean, they'd fit right into a Fast and Furious movie. So you get this kind of opulence and extravagance, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, the CGI is just incredible. Incredibly ropey. It's like that the Megan Fox film Rogue, which came out last year with terrible big cats. I mean, and hyenas as well. It's like
bad version of the Lion King. Yeah,
but I mean, it's so fast paced and so, like you say, you just kind of laugh along with it. I did kind of get some fun out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a Jeep that turns into a speedboat. What more do you want?
Yeah,
I would really sort of recommend people watch it, but probably in a sort of state that you watch Cats. I think you need to have a very low expectation and enjoy it for the total cheese it is. Mm-hmm. Jamie, is it floating your boat? Do you fancy it?
I really fancy it after hearing all this. I may watch it tonight.
I think you should.
You should. I think it's something you'd actually enjoy.
Like Matthew, I've always liked Jackie Chan. I mean, who doesn't like his early films and then his kind of Hollywood films, his kind of mid-period Hollywood stage? So, yes, I'm there for Jackie and I'm there for Robot Bees, without a doubt. So,
who doesn't? pigeons like a robot bee. And, you know, like, you will so enjoy the delivery of some of the henchmen. I just don't know where they got these people from central casting. Yeah. Yes, a non-specific Middle Eastern henchman who delivers everything like he's
yeah, it's very cartoony.
It's incredible. We sort of recommend that with the caveat that we're not saying it's great. We're saying it's very much not. And also, if anyone can tell me, if you had a solid gold car, would you actually be able to drive it? Wouldn't it be super heavy? That's one for our Is It Bollocks on our magazine. Yeah. I think I might have to find a gold bullion expert.
We need to know.
Vanguard is available on demand streaming platforms from the 8th of January, and it gets a physical release on Blu-ray and DVD from the 11th of January. Okay, so it's time to remember Robin Williams now with this.
The breaking news, actor Robin Williams is dead at the age of 63.
They believe that the Bay Area resident committed suicide.
There was a lot of media speculation.
On Robin Williams' mind before his death, money.
He's broke or he's depressed or he's just given up.
The last movie was clear to all of us on that set that something was going on with Robin.
There was something eroding within him.
I was called in to go over the coroner's report. It was the beginning of understanding what had really gone on.
Okay, so this is Robin's Wish. There's a documentary about Robin Williams. What part of his life does it cover, Matthew?
This is about the final days of Robin. Robin Williams effectively died in 2014. And it's essentially clearing up a lot of misconceptions about his death. And it highlights that very early on the fact that he had a condition called Lewy body dementia, a neurological disorder. There's a lot of speculation about exactly what drove him to take his own life. So it's kind of an awareness raiser from that point of view. There's a lot of conversations with his wife, Susan Schneider, some friends and colleagues. It's kind of clearing up a few myths. And it's also, you know, very much a heartfelt tribute to this comedian actor that many people loved and adored. So it's not essentially a biopic. It does kind of leave out quite a lot. There's quite a lot of gaps in it in terms of covering his life and career. But you get some of the early stuff. So it's much more about painting a portrait of him as he was at the end of his life with the aid of friends and family.
It feels quite slight. I don't know if you guys felt that.
Yeah, I mean, it's only 77 minutes. It feels like there's a lot more to say, really. You know, it's kind of odd that it is so short.
Yeah, and it does focus, as you say, very heavily on this diagnosis and shedding light on that. Leaves out his other family. We don't hear from his children or his first wife. We don't hear from colleagues. It's mostly his neighbours who he lived next to in his later life with his second wife. So it feels like a very segmented aspect of Robin Williams' life. But I think what was interesting for me was the Sean Levy is talking on it, who is obviously the director of Night at the Museum movies. Mm. And he talks sort of with the obvious blessing of Susan Schneider about the fact that Robin was exhibiting signs of dementia and was struggling even then when he was making those movies, trying to find a line, trying to get the comedic sort of pizzazz out of things and struggling, and they could see a difference. So from that point of view, it's great as an awareness raiser of a specific condition, but I'm not sure it actually adds anything to knowing about Robin Williams.
Like you say, it does very much focus on the end of his life. And the Lewy body dementia, I didn't know anything about it, but the kind of cognitive decline, you know, the impaired movements, and it kind of sweeps across your brain. That's why you started to forget lines, and, you know, it affects your sleep. You can't sleep. And there's all these horrible things going on, which in terms of a misconception, like I always thought I knew about his depression when he was younger, that he'd always struggled with his addiction, stuff like that. You know, there were rumours at the time that he died about money troubles, which weren't true. He just had his show The Crazy Ones cancelled after one season on TV. So was that something to do with it? So it clears up all that and sort of paints, you know, how strong he was. He had this going on. He didn't know. He hadn't been diagnosed with it. He'd only been diagnosed with Parkinson's. They didn't find out until his autopsy what the true matter was, and to cope with that and to try and work and all of that, it's lovely in that sense that it makes you realize realize, you know, just how strong he was to put up with it at all. And then he obviously made the decision he didn't want to put up with it any longer. You know, there's a moment in the film where he was a big friend of Christopher Reeve. They went to Juilliard together. And when Christopher Reeve had his accident, Robin Williams sort of says, you know, he's so strong. Like, if that happened to me, I don't think I'd want to cope with that. I don't think I would. So that sort of ties into why he took his own life. Yeah, very much so. But like you said, it's not a documentary. If you want Robin Williams's whole life, even though this touches on it, it touches on Juilliard, his freeform genius, his friendship with Christopher Reeve. There's some wonderful footage of him improvising the genie in Aladdin.
Oh, yes, that is great.
And sort of on comedy club stages and, you know, photos of him kind of entertaining the troops in Afghanistan. So you get all of these little moments, but they are just moments. You know, in a 77-minute documentary. There are other documentaries out there that if you want more of a kind of this is Robin Williams, this is his whole life and going into his career and his comedy and his films, you know, there's probably things out there that are more robust in that sense.
It's probably for the Robin Williams fan completist, isn't it? If you had questions about this period of his life and if you want to know everything about him, then this is one to watch.
Did you guys know about the fact he had Lewy body dementia before you watched this?
I don't think it was very widely publicised because I hadn't heard of the condition until I watched this documentary. So from that point of view, it's doing a good job of informing audiences about a condition.
There is footage of his wife sort of going on talk shows in America, you know, and clearing it up and saying this is what he was diagnosed with, this is why he died. So it's obviously out there in terms of she got it out there before this documentary, but for some reason, I don't know if I had my head in the sand, but it hadn't filtered down to me. So it was a revelation watching this.
And it is a weird disease in as much as it mimics lots of other diseases and the symptoms of it are non-specific and sort of it's only if you sort of put the things together and have a proper diagnosis and have a brain scan that you can really tell that this is what you might have. And it's a cruel and degenerative disease that
is incurable.
Yeah. In terms of shedding light on that, it is interesting.
Just to say, Williams also, he knew there was something deeper wrong with him, that when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, because his left hand was trembling a lot, and he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and he actually said to the doctors, he said, you know, are you sure I haven't got Alzheimer's? I haven't got dementia? Am I schizophrenic? Because he knew in that wonderful brain of his that he knew something was wrong in his brain and things were falling apart and he could no longer do things and it was all crumbling. So he knew something was wrong. So even though he wasn't diagnosed until, you know, the autopsy, he knew it wasn't Parkinson's, that there was something more to it.
Very sad. Robin's Wish is available on demand now on all digital platforms. Okay, let's move on to Palestine and to this.
I'm not quite sure that everyone can imagine what difficulties you face as a mayor in Palestine.
We don't have our own currency. We cannot visit Jerusalem. We are surrounded on all sides by Israeli settlements.
كل مرة عم بزور فيها مدينة من المدن الصديقة عم بشعر قديش احنا بإمكاننا نعمل أشياء احنا مش قادرين نعملها.
This is a documentary about the mayor of Ramallah in Palestine, Mayor Musa Hadid, who is going about his business in 2017 when Trump makes his announcement that he will recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and move the US embassy there, which obviously causes a great deal of stress and strife in Palestine. It's not just about that, though. It's not just about politics. What else is it about, Matthew? Because this is a delight. I loved this film.
I mean, it's effectively, it's about the day-to-day running of a big city. We follow this guy everywhere. And not only is he dealing with kind of world-changing events, you know, incredible political strife, you know, being in somewhere that's right in the eye of the geopolitical storm, but at the same time, he's got to deal with things like sewage and, you know, who's taking the bins out and, you know, doors in primary schools that are looking a bit tatty. I mean, it's got this incredible contrast between these huge, big events and just all the little details of day to day. And he's just this guy. I mean, he's absolutely inexhaustible. He just kind of carries on plowing through everything. I mean, he takes everything on the chin. He seems to have limitless energy.
He's always late, isn't he? Because people are always like, you have to stop for lunch. And he's like, I've got a meeting.
Come for lunch.
And they're like, you've got to have lunch. He's late for everything. And he has very long days. But there's a real charm to following him. You've hit it on the head there, that it is just this complete contrast of the global political stage with the minutiae of everyday life, which is really helpful when you're looking at this political situation, because it's just on the news all the time and it's news to us because we don't live there. And here we are, plopped right in the middle of Palestine,
to
understand what it is like to live there and to understand what their daily struggles are like. And the sewage sounds a mundane thing, but actually it's a huge thing that's going to affect loads of people, and it can't be done because Israel won't allow it. It gives you a real context for everything that happens there and a better understanding of what you're hearing in the news, I guess.
Yeah, it's a real eye-opener. I mean, I suppose they've kind of dealt with occupation for such a long time that has become part of day-to-day reality, but for us to see it that up close as well, I mean, it's really revelatory. And he's such a great guide. I mean, I suppose you could say it's maybe a little bit one-sided, and we don't really hear any sort of criticism of him. You know, there's no one offers different viewpoints to him or different ways of doing things. But I mean, he does come across as such a decent, likable guy that you can't help being compelled by him and following him all the way around this city.
I mean, not at all to make a comparison, but I think probably we get a greater sense of what it must be like to be under siege now that we are all sitting in our homes and unable to travel and unable to move, because he does talk about the limits on the people of Palestine and what they can do. They don't have their own currency. They don't have that much of an ability to travel. They can't go certain places. They're limited in what they can do. You get a real empathy for that if you're sitting at home in lockdown. And also I found the way that they sort of presented this as well, very much sort of a love letter to Palestine and this city. The opening is just him wandering down the streets past beautiful cafes with people calling out to him and this lovely music playing over the top. It really does put you right there and make you think, I'd like to go there. And it feels a bit like you're traveling, even though you're not traveling anywhere, because you do get a sense of place.
And it ends with this really lovely flourish as well. There's a lovely celebratory moment at the end. It's visually and orally, it's very impressive.
It is.
So it's a very nicely made film.
It's a film that there's talk about it being in the awards contenders for documentary. Do you think it has a good chance?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, it seems to have got a lot of exposure. I mean, before actually seeing it, I'd heard quite a lot about it. So I think word of mouth will take it quite far. I can see this doing very well.
Mm. So that is Mare, as in town mare and not a horse. Which is available on all platforms right now. And that's all we have really to talk about this week, because obviously with current affairs having shifted everything into a bit of a minefield, there's not much to watch. But we do have a magazine coming out on Friday. So if you're going on your lockdown shop around the supermarket, do seek us out. It's got on the cover, what, Matthew?
Fast and Furious 9.
Vin Diesel and 9.
John Cena together.
It's our 2021 preview, headed up by the beefiest, mustiest cover we've had in a long time. The guns on that cover, and I'm not talking about hardware. Please seek it out and find out everything we can see this year, we hope. Before we go, shall we answer a reader's question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, what's your movie New Year's resolution?
Fall asleep less in movies, especially watching them at home on the sofa under a blanket. It's been a bit of a problem this last year in particular. So I'm going to watch more standing up, I think. I'm going to
buy standing up movies. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you fall asleep in Cats? Is that why you liked it? Because you only had the first 5 minutes
and then had bizarre dreams.
Maybe I did. Yeah, who knows?
Maybe the movie you were watching was one in your head, which was better. That's why.
Could well be. Yeah.
I think Jamie's onto something there. What about you, Jamie? What's your New Year's resolution for film?
My New Year's resolution with film is to watch What the Hell I Want when I want, because every single year I always worry that I'm watching not enough movies or too many movies, because, as you know, I'm obsessive and I normally clock in about 700, 750 a year. And this year with lockdown, I broke 800. I did 807. And rather than just accept that, I then get really stressed thinking, what am I doing? I'm watching too many movies. I'm an addict. And I beat myself up about it. And then I go the other way and go, right, I'm going to really cut down. And it's almost like a diet. And I only allow myself a certain amount. And then I get really down because I'm missing movies and I want to watch more. So it's this whole neurotic thing going on in my head. So this year, I'm just saying no numbers, no limits, no anything. When I want to watch a movie, I'll watch a movie. And if that means I watch 1,000, I watch 1,000. If that means I watch 600, I watch 600. But I'll just watch what I want.
Let's remember that for next year, and we'll see how you're doing with that, because I can't believe we could get through a year with you not having an exact number in your head of what you've watched.
It will last by the end of January. I'll be obsessing again.
Yeah, you'll be like, it's this much, this many hours watched.
Yes, exactly. What's yours, Jane?
I want to watch more documentaries, because some of the films I've enjoyed most this year have actually been documentaries. And it's not that I shy away from them. In the past, I have generally enjoyed, you know, sort of fiction more than real life. But actually, I've just seen some absolute corkers, and there's this whole other world that I need to get into, and I want to watch more documentaries. Mare being one of them. I thoroughly enjoyed that. My most favourite one recently is Truffle Hunters.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Wonderful film.
Old men and their dogs. Yeah.
And, you know, perhaps in another year, I might not have watched that, because I'd have had so much tentpole sort of fictional stuff coming down the line. But I'd watched it this year, and I adored it. So that's mine.
I've got to say, in 2020, there were so many good documentaries. Yeah. I don't know how many you think, but there was Boys State, there was Collective, Painting
great.
The Thief.
Yeah, Painting the Thief. Yeah, I love them.
Max Richter's Sleep was wonderful. You know, there's so many good ones out there.
Mm-hmm.
The competition
is really good year.
Really strong. So that's a good resolution to have, Jane.
Okay, so we'll have more of this next week and the week after and the week after until we get back into cinemas. And obviously, I'm sure all our resolution this year is to get back into the cinema.
Without a doubt.
Where, that'd be lovely.
And together as a gang. The Total Film gang has not been together in a seat row all together sharing popcorn for a long time, have they?
No.
A hell of a long time.
We will get back to that.
March last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Invisible Man was the last film I saw in a cinema. Well, at a screening. I did actually see Tenet. That's the only one after lockdown and stuff that I ever went to see. Can't wait to get back.
Can't wait to get back and share the old sweet and salty. Okay, so it's time to say goodbye. We will see you next week. Bye.
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 I want you back for good.